Did you know you can save up to 70% on the best brands just by shopping at FromRebel.com? We're talking about strollers, car seats, high chairs, espresso machines, cookware, everything you need for way less. Here's how it works. Every single day, Rebel drops thousands of new products on the site for up to 70% off. It is a constant stream of endless deals from top brands like Abba Baby, Nuna, Baby Bjorn, Breville, Nespresso, KitchenAid, Le Creuset, and more. But you have to act fast because every deal is one of a kind. So if you see something you love, make sure you add to cart fast. So stop paying full price when you don't have to. Whether it's baby gear, kitchen upgrades, or a treasure for your home you didn't know you needed, Rebel has it for way less, up to 70% less. Shop from Rebel.com and save big.
Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with renowned journalist, author, and podcaster, Jake Wallace Simons. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show. Your donations ensure that I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. So when is never? Because never again was considered to be a moral imperative on October 6th, 2023. And then on October 7th, it happened again. Not just the unimaginable terror that Hamas unfurled on the innocent civilians of Israel, the world's only Jewish state, but the utterly shameful and unmitigated moral turpitude of a global community that has fallen all over itself to defend the terrorists, even as it narcissistically prides itself on its social justice and lofty ideals. And even in the quiet of a ceasefire, their calls for intifada and jihad get louder and louder, ratcheting up the Islamic war on the Jews and, quite frankly, their war on the West. So is never again now, again, or is it just until next time? Jake Wallace Simons is a columnist, broadcaster, and foreign correspondent. He co-hosts the Brink podcast with my A Paratrooper and a Yogi Walk into the Bar co-host, Andrew Fox. A former editor and current writer for the Jewish Chronicle, he also writes for outlets including the Daily Telegraph and the Spectator. His newest and highly acclaimed book, Never Again, How the West Betrayed Jews and Itself, comes on the heels of his 2023 bestseller, Israelophobia, which won the Daily Telegraph Book of the Year. He has also written 4 award-winning novels, has reported globally for the Daily Mail, Telegraph, and the BBC. Jake, thank you so much for joining me today. It's such an incredible honor.
Hello, great to see you.
So your newest book, it has a question mark at the end. So how would you say it? Never again?
Yeah, I normally say never again, question mark. That's normally how I put it for people.
Because yeah. I want to, you know, so maybe if I were a better actor, I could make that question mark work for me. But for the sake of I'm not a great actor, I'm just going to say never again. Anyway, it really and truly is so eloquent and utterly illuminating. If we had 9 hours, I would just opt for reading it out loud. But in the interest of time, I'll just try to touch upon as many concepts as possible and urge all of our listeners to buy the book themselves. It's a simultaneously poetic and deeply disturbing read. But before we get into the new book, on September 7th, 2023, exactly 1 month before the October 7th massacre, you published another book, Israelophobia. And that was eerily prescient of the tsunami of Jew hatred that was about to flood the world. Perhaps it was prophetic, maybe just astute, as everyone from Ben Shapiro to Barry Weiss to, well, to be honest, me, predicted Israel would maintain the world's sympathies for 2, maybe 3 weeks at most. No one assumed it would be 2 to 3 hours. Did you?
Well, so that's a good question. I mean, firstly, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be with you to talk about these very important things. Yeah, Israelophobia. I mean, it feels like a long time ago now that it came out. It was pre-October the 7th, and everything feels a long time ago before October the 7th. It was definitely one of those 9/11 moments where you had the world before and then the world after. But yes, you're right. It came out on September the 7th, 2023. Exactly a month before October the 7th took place. And yeah, I mean, in many ways, I suppose it gave the lay of the land. It sort of charted the dry channels through which the flood of anti-Semitism would flow after October the 7th. But I've got to admit that I think I was slightly taken by surprise at how quickly the world turned against Israel. I mean, of course, there were the radicals who you can't call it protesting on October the 7th because there was nothing to protest. They were celebrating. We had them in London outside the Israeli embassy on the day itself when the massacres were still taking place. You had them in New York in Times Square, I believe, or elsewhere. And so there were those guys, but they very quickly picked up such a weight of numbers. It became such a huge number of people who were behind them. And there was no attempt to stem the flow of propaganda coming from Hamas, amplified by the UN, by other NGOs, and by the media. In fact, the media and others didn't just fail to stand in the way of it. They actually magnified it and helped to deliver it into millions of homes. And all of that, I mean, you know, we knew what was going to happen. We could have predicted it, but I think that the scale and the pace of it took even me by surprise.
Yeah. It's I was also marveling just thinking about this last night, how in the beginning at least they were wearing masks. And today, not only are they not wearing masks, but you just have some, you know, girl from her dorm room without a mask calling for death to all Jews, and this has become completely acceptable, even if reprehensible. People literally like, okay, yeah, okay. So I'm curious, like, not curious because I've read your book, but how do you explain the sickness of this world that is so willfully blind and utterly tone deaf to what would otherwise be considered a very bright line between good and evil?
Good. I mean, another big question. I mean, the masks is an interesting thing. You know, you only really wear a mask if you feel the need to hide your face, if you feel a sense of shame or a sense of consequence might follow your actions. And there are masks of different sorts. There's obviously the physical mask that people place in front of their faces, but there's also the numerous non-physical masks, like using the word Zionist when what you really want to say is Jew, for example.
Yeah.
That's another kind of mask. Or using the word Netanyahu when what you really want to say is Jews, or the Israeli government when what you really want to say is Jews. All of these masks have come in very useful for the anti-Semites who've dominated so much of our society over the last 2 years. And they've come in handy because I think we still have some sense of shame deriving from Never Again, deriving from the Holocaust. You know, we live in a society where racism is the deepest sin, the worst thing that anybody can do. It's so bad that we hallucinate racism where racism doesn't exist all the time throughout society under the influence of the radical left. But with that comes an agenda, and that agenda is racist in itself. You know, we can talk about this perhaps, but you know, the only way to overcome racism is to reduce people's focus on race as a division in society, not to emphasize it. And yet anti-racism has been co-opted into the cause of emphasizing a division between races. And Jews have done very badly out of that. You know, anti-Semitism is, as I said in my first book, the Israelophobia, first nonfiction book, is a shape-shifting virus that takes on the language of the time to present itself as part of the solution for a better society. You know, in the Middle Ages, it was presented as a religious movement to kill the Jews who were the Christ killers. You know, if you have a people who who have committed deicide, then they themselves are a malign influence and society needs to be free of them. In the 20th century, antisemitism was presented as a way to save the world from a subhuman race that was masquerade, might look human, live among us, but actually are controlling the world, poisoning the wells, controlling the banking system, the media, bringing us down from within. And so the only right and brave thing to do is to exterminate them, to free the world from them. And now in this world that is supposed to have learnt the lesson of never again, by which racism is the worst sin anybody can do, antisemitism has come into that new warped ideology, warped anti-racism, by saying we've got to rid the world of Israel and of Jews because they are the racists, they are the white supremacists, they are the colonialists, they are practicing apartheid, and of course they are practicing genocide. So once again, you see the same trick played on society and on the world that has been played for not just hundreds, but even thousands of years, representing bigotry and antisemitism actually as something virtuous and right and just. And that same thing is happening now and is clearly intoxicating for millions of people around the world, particularly younger people who are looking for a cause, who have largely meaningless lives that are saturated by screens and by social media, that have been screwed over often by the economy, that live in a society which has diluted or fractured family bonds, high rates of suicide, of depression, of mental illness, and just completely surrounded by cosseted indulgence. Those are the people searching for meaning. And they thought they had it with the environmental protests and environmental radicalism. It kind of worked, but not really. They thought they had it with the transgender stuff and that kind of worked, but again, it's a bit fringe. They certainly had it for a while with the Black Lives Matter protests, which swept the world in 2020, but they died out. But it seems now that the Jews, once again, have become the omni-cause behind which all progressive radicals of all different stripes and persuasions can unify and feel like they're the good guys.
Yeah. It's interesting because, first of all, this concept of anti-racism, it's flat-out racism. It just is. And anybody who's paying attention knows that it is. I have so many things I wanted to discuss before this, but I'm gonna jump ahead to address something that you just brought up. And before that, Jake, something that's very interesting to me, to be honest, is that as these raging anti-Semites are so unapologetically Jew hating. Nobody wants to be called an anti-Semite. Like they'll fight to the death that, oh no, but I'm not anti-Semitic, but kill the Jews. So before I even move on, like how there is such a cognitive dissonance. And also there's a way to hate without calling for death. And so there's a line that's been crossed with no other group. I mean, in modern day, in this era of forced niceness. Like, why do you think they're so open to crossing that line?
I think it's just because they really, really want to. You know, they want something to get their blood up. They want to have a cause. They want to feel like the Crusaders, to use that term, against injustice and against evil. That's what they want. They need some meaning in their lives. Also, it's often, particularly with younger people, it's their social life. It's trendy. It's fashionable. It's something they want to do because their friends are doing it and they can all feel together like the rebellious, virtuous ones, like previous generations have in different ways. So that's not necessarily new. But and of course, anti-Semitism is hardly new either. But I think that what we're seeing now is that there's a little very neat parcel of thinking, which says that you can get out of being accused of being anti-Semitic, so long as you claim to like some Jews, and that works. You know, so if you can bring yourself to put up with one or two Jewish friends, then that enables you to avoid the allegation of being anti-Semitic. Or to put it more sharply, it's this distinction people seem to draw between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, saying that, you know, I don't hate Jews, I just hate the fact that they want to have somewhere to be safe. It's that little neat sort of nugget of thinking that that protects people from allegations of anti-Semitism and then allows them to give full force to it while not recognizing themselves their own bigotry. And it's to the shame of the sensible grown-up people that we haven't, as a whole, seen through this and criticized it and diminished it and discredited it with all the force that we should have done.
Okay. I guess that my real question or difficulty with grappling with this is that there's bigotry, there's racism, and then there's put the Zions in the ground. Okay, so it's not the same. In nobody, like, when's the last time there was 100,000 people every single weekend trolling to lynch the blacks? I mean, I want to think that since the civil rights era, we've moved on to a place that even if you want to say I'm against fill in the blank, the war in Gaza, that it doesn't come down to now let's kill all the Jews wherever we could find them from the so-called good people of the world. There's a disconnect and a double standard that doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think the thing is we have moved on in a way, but in another way, we really haven't. The way in which we've moved on is that it's no longer okay to have 100,000 people in the streets wanting to lynch blacks. That's not okay anymore. It's not okay to have 100,000 people in the streets wanting to lynch Jews either, if that's what they were saying in the same way as they did before the civil rights movement. We want to lynch Jews. That would be unacceptable. The society would not accept that. Mm-hmm. But the way in which things haven't changed is that people are still doing it so long as they can give it a new kind of packaging, a new kind of wording that will allow people to doubt whether it is what it looks like. And that's the genius, really, of anti-Semitism in particular. It is able to repackage itself generation after generation. And it's really what led me to want to call my previous book Israelophobia, because I felt that was a way of encapsulating the new form of anti-Semitism without being diverted into debates about whether anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. I mean, it's just so obvious, really, that if you hate Israel in exactly the same way as people in medieval times hated the Jews, if you accuse Israel of the same blood libels, if you wish to exterminate it in the same way, if you accuse it in the same way of having malign influence over the levers of power throughout the world, and if you lie about it continuously, if you're obsessed by it, if you get a kind of almost sexual thrill out of wishing to see its destruction, that's the same hatred with different language. But the fact that it has this different language, it's co-opted the language of virtue. These people present themselves as anti-racist, as anti-colonialist, as only they're only marching because they care about Palestinian children. That new language is what has changed, and it allows us not to change. It allows us to take the lynch mobs of the 1950s or 60s and to transfer them with new language and get away with it again.
Yeah, I think that in this modern age, we look at the old blood libels it's gonna come out wrong, but sort of with a chuckle, like, really? Baby's blood and matzah? Where's the red part? You know, like, and it all seems sort of ludicrous and naive, and that maybe that was, you know, hundreds or thousands of years ago that people could fall for this kind of craziness. And yet you want to believe that we live in somehow a more informed, awake, or aware, or educated society that understands the ridiculousness of this concept. I mean, this issue of like intersectional, I'll use your word, Israelophobia, because I agree the way you use it, it really is interchangeable, especially today, with anti-Semitism or Jew hatred, but it's confounded every observer who has even like a modicum of intellectual discernment. As you've written, so I have a quote here, show me a fanatical transgender campaigner, climate change campaigner, or decolonization campaigner, and chances are I'll show you an anti-Semite as soon as easily, as I may in Charlottesville or Islamabad. Now, never mind that while homosexuality is widespread, accepted, and even celebrated in Israel, it's literally illegal in every Arab country other than Jordan and Bahrain. Never mind that Israel is one of the most environmentally forward nations on earth, with global leadership in water and agricultural tech in particular. And never mind that Zionism is actually the ultimate decolonization project. I know this question can be answered in one word, but I'll ask it anyway. If the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and Israel is actually not the enemy of any of these causes that they, the intersectional elite claim, why has the entire intersectional biosphere turned against exactly one quote unquote enemy in the entire world? And are they honestly unable to see the hypocrisy in their activism?
It's interesting. Something that is only really occurring to me now as we speak in more clarity is that I think that a lot of this is about faith, the experience of faith. You know, you're sort of appealing, you're saying why in a world that's supposed to be rational, that is supposed to be reasonable, is supposed to be law abiding, where we have rules and principles and values and science and psychoanalysis and the humanities and culture and art and all those things, why hasn't that been sufficient to stop the hatred and to stop the animalistic impulses of previous eras? And I think that perhaps faith has something to do with it, because, you know, the human being is not just simply a rational or cultured person. We have many different levels of depth, and for, you know, since the beginning of recorded time, a lot of that has been bound up with faith and intuition and religion, I suppose, in different ways. And the Jews have been on the sharp end of that, don't get me wrong. You know, in from the blood libel, of course, was a religious mania first and foremost. But I think that something has happened with the doing down of faith in our modern society, with the rise of secularism, left, you know, what I think it was Chesterton called a God-shaped hole. You know, it left a vacuum mm-hmm. there, left a certain instinct unquenched, I suppose. And people, you know, we still have an instinct to faith, a drive to faith, but we no longer have a belief in the previous objects of faith that we had in previous generations. This isn't as much the case in America, but certainly it's the case in Europe and increasingly in America too. And I think that that faith, that impulse to believe things religiously goes a long way to explaining people's enthusiasm for hating Israel and hating the Jews. It's a religious thing, really. The fervor and the zeal that they show is something of faith. The commitment to the cause, the utter dogmatism, the refusal to brook any dissent, and the aggression that rides on the back of that, even murderous aggression, it's all something of religion. And I think that when we talk about the alliance between the Islamist radicals and the progressives, secular progressive radicals, it feels something of a disconnection, because you've got people who are deeply religious and people who aren't. But actually, in a way, you've got two groups of people who are deeply religious, but just in different ways. And they both have one article of faith very much in common, which is hatred for the Jews.
Yeah. So I'm going to actually come back to a quote actually that I pulled on this topic also from your book, when you said, "It has often been remarked that the zealous blindness shown by the activists towards our own contradictions resembles a sublimated faith devoted through cultural emptiness and the unquenchable ego rather than God." To me, it seems that this intersectionality has become their new God. It's become their new religion, and that we live in a largely godless society, not just secular, but literally godless. Most people I know, it ironically, in the yoga world, which, not that you would necessarily know this about yoga, but the very concept of yoga is predicated on submission to a higher power. That is like the foundation of the whole practice. And yet, almost every enlightened yoga person I know considers themselves atheist, and they consider this to be the enlightened way of seeing the world, that they're bigger and they're better than religion. And it's interesting, Jake, because you noted in your book, you had a more than a paragraph, that a lot of young people today identify as quote unquote spiritual, and that this is a cry for meaning, or for purpose, or that maybe other generations aren't stepping in to provide what we were provided as children. But the funny thing is, I coming from this perspective of the world of love and light, I see this very differently. I see this calling themselves spiritual as just another form of virtue signaling. That is really just a blatant repudiation of traditional religion, like feigning to have some sort of higher calling behind it.
You could be right, but they're not saying that they're atheists. There was that moment in the early 2000s, the new atheist movement with Sam Harris, Dan Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, and Richard Dawkins, who were known as the four horsemen of the new atheism. And that moment, I remember it well, the books like The God Delusion by Dawkins and God Is Not Great by Hitchens and so on. That was a very, it was an act of huge rebellion. It was an act of proper rebellion, of real anti-establishment destruction by on the path on the part of those new atheists. I'm not saying this to disparage them. I hugely admire many of them, all of them actually, intellectually. But that was shocking for people. And the amount of notoriety that they attracted and attention that they attracted, the amount of money they made, I dare say, is testament to how shocking it was for people, how disruptive it was, how subversive it was. And I don't think that young people today calling themselves spiritual is any more shocking than that. I don't feel that it comes from the same instincts to want to destroy the establishment, to oppose our traditions and customs and values. I think it's something else. I do think I don't think that young people these days, many of them are kind of ballsy enough to do that. They're not cut of the same cloth as that lot in the 2000s. I feel it's that they realize that along with the bathwater, we've thrown out the baby and they want the baby back. They just don't know how it looks because they've never seen it. They want to feel something wholesome and spiritual. And the word spiritual is a pretty bad word, but it's the only one that they can come up with without saying they're not religious. They haven't known religion. They don't know what it means. They don't know perhaps their vocabulary isn't extended enough to have other words. They probably don't know what the word numinous means, for example. So they land on spirituality, and it's a good word in a way. It says what it says what it means, and it says what they want. But it also has the disadvantage of being totally vague. It has no definition. You could be spiritual anything. Muslim, Hindu, Zoroastrian, Buddhist, yoga, whatever. It has no meaning, but they know they want something. They know they want to be moved, their spirit to be moved. They just don't know where to turn for it, or what it's like, what it's going to be like if they ever get there.
God, I hate to answer such a brilliant response with something so mundane, but I'll tell you my theory, Jake, quite honestly, is if you look at forms and it gives you a choice, it says like Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, whatever, spiritual. And so they so or atheist or agnostic in maybe. But a lot of times, it's just a choice, and you're like, well, I know I'm not Christian, I know I'm not Jewish, F the Jews, I know I'm not this. Okay, well, I'm more spiritual. And I think it's a toss away personally, but that's just
Yeah,
cynical, Shauna.
I agree with you. I think you could be right. It's difficult to generalize. I'm sure there are a lot of people like that. I think there are a lot of people also who say spiritual. What they really mean is the religion of the ego. I mean, one of the, as you said, one of the defining characteristics of religion is submission. You know, that's what Islam means. I'm not talking about Islam, but it's submission to a higher power, but also a higher system of wisdom and morality that you are a supplicant in front of, and you take on because you haven't got it, and that's what you want. You try to aspire. You're trying to grow towards something greater that's provided by somebody or something that's greater than you. And spirituality has the convenience of having no priest, no system, no religion, no morality, other than indulging your own intuitions and instincts. And so I think it can be an ego-dominated affair. So I'm not saying that you're wrong. You're right, and it's difficult to generalize. But I do think there's something in there, though, of yearning for something more, which I think young people are feeling. And in fact, it's also mirrored in the increase amongst young people in Britain, certainly, in interest in Christianity. Christianity on the whole is in decline, both here and in the States. Excuse me. But there's been a resurgence recently within the overall decline, particularly amongst young people, particularly among men in Britain. And I think it's similar in America, but a different picture there. But they're being attracted not to the Church of England, which is basically like, I don't know how to put it in a way that translates to American culture. It's like, I don't know, it's like kind of soft left Democrats pretending to be religious, if you know what I mean. It has no core to it really anymore. But they're being attracted to the Catholic Church and non-establishment denominations that still have their red meat faith because they want some authenticity with it. So it's those people that I'm talking about, really.
Just curious, when you say recently, do you mean recently as in since the murder of Charlie Kirk? Because we saw a huge spike at that pivotal moment, or is this a broader trend that you've seen?
No, the last year, two, three, four, 5 years, okay. Something like that.
Interesting. I, you know, all of the reports that I see say that that Islamism or whatever, Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world, and I want to touch upon this for a minute. Before I do, I was watching your Brink episode actually with Andrew yesterday. Were you as shocked as I was that when you asked what the biggest threat to Britain was, that the answers were China and Russia, and then maybe sort of Iran on the fringes, and you guys had to bring Islam into the conversation?
No, I wasn't surprised by that. Okay. I think it's true in terms of state. I mean, we were interviewing at that time. It was Tom Tugendhat who was responding, who was the security minister. And of course, Iran is a far less sophisticated adversary than certainly another China and indeed Russia. It's much more a terrorist group than a security service in some ways. But of course, we face threats from non-state actors, terror groups, homegrown terror, radicalism, jihadism, and Islamism from within Britain. But he was talking really about state actors to begin with.
Got it.
Of those, definitely China and Russia are more significant than the Iranians, or the Iranians are also very dangerous. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I was listening with one ear, I have to admit.
No, you're right. You're right to bring that up.
What am I missing here?
Yeah, you're right to bring that.
Okay. So, I mean, because I didn't know, there's so many people are just afraid to like just say the word. And I personally, I have absolutely no illusions about the role of Islamism in fostering this like really threatening global climate that we're facing. But I'm curious how much of this Israelophobic vitriol that we see vomiting onto our streets and our campuses, do you think at its core is Islamic in nature? Because it was started with a disinformation campaign that was launched on October 7th. And how much is it just the work of these leftist lemmings run amok?
That's a good question. I don't know is the answer to that. It's difficult to quantify. I mean, I could give you my impression, but I've got no data really to draw on. Certainly Muslims, there are many more Muslims in Britain and in Europe than there are in America proportionately. We've got, I think it's about up to about 6% of British Britain's population are Muslim, about 10%, I think, in France. In America, I think it's about 2%, something like that. 1%, right? So it's much, much smaller as a proportion of your population. And the Muslim communities in Britain and Europe are largely dominated by radicals. Particularly the Muslim Brotherhood is a jihadi organization. It's the wellspring of all other jihadi groups, so Al-Qaeda, Islamic State, even the Iranian regime, Hamas, of course, are all offshoots in different ways, or have a lineage that goes back to the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood aims to work subtly over a period of generations, using violence, but only as a last resort. So it prefers to embed itself in a culture, to take control of community centers, of education, of charities, then to gain political power, working through the corridors of Westminster in Britain, or wherever, Paris or Washington, and then influencing laws, getting political representation, and enforcing Sharia and Islamization from within, gradually over generations, rather than with violence. So violence they'll draw upon if they need to. And we have that active in Britain and in Europe and in the States. The Muslim Brotherhood is a group that's banned across the Arab world, in Egypt, where it was founded, in Jordan, in Syria, in UAE, in Bahrain, elsewhere, banned because they know it to be an extremist threat. And so after being banned across the Middle East, it's relocated largely to the West. And in Britain, what that means is that Muslims who are, to use that hackneyed word, moderate, who aren't enemies of the West and Britain, can't speak their mind because their communities are dominated by these Islamist fanatics. And if they were to speak out or to assimilate or whatever, they would run the risk of reprisals. And meanwhile, the extremists present themselves to the world, to government, to the public as representatives of the community. And any attack on them is an attack on Muslims as a whole. And use means such as, for example, trying to criminalize the term Islamophobia, which they're trying to do in Britain at the moment, which would mean that criticizing Islam in any way would be illegal, and criticizing the Islamists would be illegal. So able to further their agenda in that way. We've got five, what they call Gaza independents. So they're members of parliament, sitting in parliament, who were elected purely on a platform of Gaza radicalism, who basically are Islamists. So they have political representation there now, whose political campaigning was characterized by mob violence against their opponents. It was really heinous and shameful. So that it does seem as if they're making great strides in Britain, and this is a big part of the problem that we face.
No irony that the whole concept of this Islamophobia was created literally to shut down any criticism of Islam, but at the same time, the people in the West who think that they're standing up for Islam, their big call is for free speech. So never mind that. But I guess that people, I think that people, when they see these marches and these protesters against Israel or against the Jews, even if they have a knee-jerk reaction, okay, this is not a good thing, it's also not us. But there are broader implications, social implications to this moral depravity that's been revealed since October 7th. So I guess that as Western civilization, or at least what was once called civilization, goes further and further to the self-hating and self-destructive left. Like, can you explain, like, why isn't this just about the Jews? Why is it not just the Jews who have to start running for cover?
You mean why is radical Islam a threat to everybody, or?
Yeah, that these thronging masses, even if they it on the On the surface seems to be against Israel, it's against something way bigger. It's against Western civilization, and as most easily evidenced by the fact that they also burn, British and American flags. But people are like, oh, well, that's only because we support the Zionists. But it's not. There's a broader agenda here.
Well, I think it's useful perhaps to think about the different sorts of anti-Semite that there are. There's, in my book, I talk about the three radicalisms, the three tribes of the new radicalism, as it were. And they all have different radical natures, but the overlap is very much in their hatred of Jews and Israel in particular. And the three tribes are the Islamist radicals, which we've just talked about, the progressive radicals, which again we've talked about a bit, and the third is the nationalist chauvinists, the white supremacists, the Nazis, the far right, whatever you want to call them. And these three tribes have different relationships with the West and with the establishment and with the Jews. They all hate the Jews for different, perhaps with different, I was going to say for different reasons, but similar reasons, but with different language and different logic. And the way in which they hate the West is again different. So if we take them in turn, so the Islamists, I suppose they hate the Jews, partly with Quranic validation or validation from the Hadith, but I think more it's more a modern phenomenon really, is Islamic Jew hatred. It's more from the 20th century, and it's got to do with the fact that the Muslim civilization dominated the world for many centuries until it fell to Christendom, and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire after the First World War was the final real humiliation, showing that the Muslim Empire had crumbled irredeemably. And that led to a real sense of humiliation and loss and disorientation, I think, amongst many Muslims across the Middle East, and a real resentment of the democracies that had made it happen, Britain and France in particular. And the you know with the spread of Western powers came the idea of the nation state. This was something new for many people living in Muslim lands. The millions upon millions who lived in under the Ottoman Empire had never had a nation state before. They lived in tribes, in clans, according to their ethnicity, under the domination of an empire ruled from Turkey. So the idea of the nation state with borders and a flag and a system of government under which everyone's equal was new. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the advent of Hitler meant that they had a hero who was going to fight with them against Britain and France. He had a strong blood and soil nationalism, which they could perhaps relate to in some way. And during the war, Hitler worked with, in particular, Haj Amin al-Husseini, the leader of the Palestinians, to blend Islamic belief and culture with Nazi racism to produce this Islamist cocktail, which Husseini then pumped out as a propagandist throughout the Middle East, brainwashing people to hate the Jews in the same way as the Nazis did, only with a Muslim language. And that's really where it starts. And so you can see that their hatred of Jews is part of their hatred of the Western democracy and Western values. And of course, it's pumped up by the jihadi religious rhetoric as well. So it's always been for Muslims, the modern Muslim anti-Semitism has always been linked with their resentment of the West. And I suppose for progressives, it comes from certainly very much from hatred of the West. If you go back to the Cold War, when then these battle of ideas, this battle of ideas was really raging. That's when the Western left came of age in alignment with the Soviet Union and developed this hatred of capitalism and Western culture as a whole through alignment with the socialists, with the communists. And as I explore in Israelophobia, a big part of the Soviet Union's propaganda output was hatred for Israel. They had a team of what they called Zionologists in the Kremlin who took old anti-Semitic tropes from Tsarist times, from within the protocols of the Elders of Zion, or even from Mein Kampf and elsewhere, and gave it new language. So they came up with ideas like Zionism is racism, Zionism is Nazism, white supremacy, ethnic cleansing, apartheid. All of those things were invented by Soviet propagandists and pumped into the West via their touch points with left-wing activists all over the different countries in the West. So you can see there on in the progressive left as well, The animus against Jews is part of their hatred of Western democracy too. And finally, the final three of our triumvirate of evil, the Nazis, the white supremacists. Well, look, they're ultra nationalists. You know, in America, I don't know what it is about America, but you've always had a real problem with race in your society in a way that we have never had in Britain here. You know, go back to World War II, you had actual Nazis marching for Hitler in a way that we didn't. An American Nazi Party, even today you have actual Nazis. Websites like the Daily Stürmer, modeled on Der Stürmer, you have actual Nazis there. We don't have them here. We don't really go in for that very much on the whole. And so I think that that is part of it's a racialized thing, isn't it? It's a white supremacist thing. Mm-hmm. That's always been the American preoccupation on that side of politics. And it's against the kind of poisoning of the white race, and blacks and Jews are the enemy. And so I suppose, you know, the modern secular pluralistic society, which gives blacks and Jews an equal voice in their democracy, which gives them equal rights as citizens, is an enemy for white nationalists alongside the Jews. And so the Jews, again, are hated along with society, with the West, with the sort of values that you and I believe, and they favor a kind of chauvinistic, you know, Putin style, Hitler style authoritarianism instead. And so I suppose, sorry, this is turning into a bit of a lecture, but those three tribes, it was a complicated question. You know, that's why the Jews are hated by all those different people along with the West itself.
Yeah. That's okay. I like your lectures. So as long as we're touching upon Nazis, I actually want to make a point that both of our grandfathers were fierce patriots who fought in World War II. They were men of courage, conviction, and a deep love for their countries. So growing up, I always admired it. It was the biggest part of his identity. I always admired how my grandfather carried his pride, like this badge of honor. He was so proud to be a veteran, and he was so proud to be an American, and he was so proud to be a Jew. But Jake, I honestly never felt the weight of that pride until I heard you speaking to Brendan O'Neill about your own grandfather, who was a proud veteran, a proud Brit, and a proud Jew. Because that's when it hit me that their pride wasn't just about service or sacrifice. It was about belonging. It was about the rare and precious ability to be both fully Jewish and fully part of a great nation. And that realization, quite honestly, broke my heart. Because why should that sense of belonging ever be something that we have to earn, defend, or plead for? Shouldn't it just be our birthright at this point?
I suppose it should. You know, it's one of the things that happens when antisemitism grows and spreads is that Jews become Jews first. You know, before October the 7th, I think people, Jewish people in Britain, and I expect in America too and elsewhere, had their Jewishness as part of who they were. I mean, different Jews are different, obviously, depending on your level of observance or assimilation or whatever. But on the whole, I think you had your Jewish identity, but then you were also your job. You were also a father or mother or brother, a resident of London or New York or Manchester or wherever else. You know, a supporter of your football team or baseball team, you know, a voter for Democrat or Republican or Tory or Labour or Lib Dems or whomever else. You had these multiple identities, but the rise of anti-Semitism has made everyone feel Jewish first because they're seen as Jewish first, because once you're defined as being a Jew, then you're put in a different category. And this is a sad feature that's always accompanied the rise of anti-Semitism. Even in Nazi Germany, when Hitler came to power in 1933, there followed a brief sort of renaissance of Jewish life in Germany, because Jews were now seen as Jewish before they were anything else. And in fact, it eclipsed all other elements of their identity. And so they were forced to look for community outside the mainstream amongst each other. And so synagogue attendance went up, Jewish observance went up, Jewish cultural events went up for a brief period until, of course, it was stamped out. And I feel that we're seeing a similar thing now, that Jews here in Britain, to give an example, have always combined their Jewishness and their patriotism. You know, in I don't know what it's like in America, but in synagogues in Britain, every Shabbat, every Saturday, people recite prayers for the health of the king and the royal family in a very prominent way, placed in the service, and often the prayer is engraved at the front on the wall. Mm-hmm. It's always been part of that. But I think now people are being forced to feel, to choose almost, to feel like Jews, to be isolated from the mainstream, which then I suppose gets us talking about Zionism, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm not only do we do a prayer for our country, but I actually read it in synagogue and posted it because I read it for my grandfather Schwarzite, in fact, because again, his patriotism and his pride in being a vet was everything to him. And so, but that's not been lost on me, especially in the last 2 years, that when I go to, to reinforce what you're saying, I mean, I've been going to synagogue every Shabbat since October 7th, right? So, but there are these October 7th, or I guess some people are calling them the October 8th Jews, but there's also this deeply disturbing trend of the Jews for Jihad, right? I don't know what else to call them, who who have become traitors to our nation. I don't know what else to call them, but I'm wondering, like, if you think that I love the term suicidal empathy that Gad Saad uses. I just think it's so precise. You use a very similar term in your book, but this suicidal empathy that's run, like, really tragically rampant among the world Jewish community, I'm wondering if you think that it's the flip side of this same sort of patriotic coin that our grandfathers carried. I mean, my grandfather used to always say, the worst anti-Semite is the Jewish anti-Semite. Self-loathing is a common psychological phenomenon. But when that loathing literally threatens your life and the future of your family, it seems as if it becomes more of a sociopathy than anything. Do you think that the post 10/7 self-hating Jew is acting out of true empathetical confusion? Or do you think that it's more of a survival instinct that's been spurred by centuries of intergenerational trauma?
Good question. I think that there's a large part of it is about a reaction from a people that has been under pressure of persecution for so long. You know, the Jews have always had amongst their number these sorts of people who perhaps are driven by some sense of self-preservation to side with the enemy. You know, the blood libel, which we've talked about, derived from 1144 in Norwich, in the east of England, when a young boy called William was found dead, and it was blamed on the Jews who were accused of using the blood in their cooking, a ritual cooking. But that allegation was first made by somebody called Theobald of Cambridge, who himself was a Jew, who said that when I was Jewish before I converted to Christianity, I got to see what my fellow Jews were up to, and we used to kill children to use their blood in our cooking.
Wow!
So the blood libel is a Jewish invention. It's an act of Jewish genius, and it was picked up with great enthusiasm by Christendom and eventually by the world of Islam as well. So there've always been people like that, you know, Theobald of Cambridge, and I think that if we fast forward to the present day, there's more complexity to this than that. I mean, I'm sure that's part of it, the instinct of people who, I mean, remember a few years ago, even way before October the 7th, during, I think, the 2014 conflict, we had some progressive Jews in Parliament Square reciting Kaddish for the Palestinian victims of Israeli brutality. Most of them were Hamas. So they were saying Kaddish for Hamas, and it became a thing. That was even before October the 7th. But those are the radicals. But I think that you have various things going on. You know, with Jews are, they tend on the whole to have a couple of characteristics which has been lost by most people in the West, or by many people in the West, or by the elite, certainly. The two that come to mind is one, a sense for danger and risk that's approaching. You know, Christopher Hitchens, to speak, mention him again, he cited Victor Klemperer, you know, the diarist of the Holocaust, as describing Jews as a seismic people who feel the first tremors of a coming earthquake more keenly than other people due to long centuries of persecution. So there's that. But there's also a sense of peoplehood that we have, that we haven't forgotten, that hasn't been beaten out of us. I mean, if you look at the number of Christians being killed across the Middle East, and then you look at the number of Christians who actually care about that in the West, you won't find very many. Whereas with Jews, it's very different. When a Jewish person is killed or badly treated, abused, whatever, Jews care. Jews give charity, Jews help, Jews pull together, because we have that sense of peoplehood still. And those two things are what inform someone like me or you to stand up against the lies that are being leveled against the state of Israel, to stand up for what's right, to refuse to let go of our sense of right and wrong, no matter how many people are ranged against us, and to fight them as part of the great Jewish effort to fight back that's taking place across the globe. But then there are other types of Jew as well, not just the Theobald of Cambridge instinct, but there's also Jews who are more cozily embedded in the West, or so cozily embedded in the West that it's eroded those senses of peoplehood and of danger. You know, if you're a Jew who inclines to the left of politics, who is quite privileged and has quite a comfortable position in life, and likes your friends are on the West, on the left. you like being on the left. That's where you feel comfortable, and you're quite wealthy and so on and so forth, and never really experienced hardship or anti-Semitism that you've noticed. Then you know you're part of what the historian Simon Sebag Montefiore described as the comfort democracies. Israel is a democracy, but it's not a comfort democracy. Britain, America, Europe. Comfort democracies, an age of gluttony, of softness, of indulgence, and that changes how people are. It numbs your sense of danger, and it increases your sense of complacency. And of course, with this age of what I call centrist fundamentalism, peoplehood has been something that we've been encouraged to repress. We can talk about that perhaps separately. So I think if you're Jewish, but you're on the left in a centrist fundamentalist comfort democracy, you've got your assimilated Western sense of self and ideals rooting mm-hmm. you away from your peoplehood in contradiction to your sense of danger. And I think the siren call of Israelophobia is quite powerful for those people, because let's face it, you can't be on the left anymore and support Israel. And so if you want to stay on the left, if you're a Jew, you got to hate Israel. And a lot of people fall into that trend. And I think that one of the main fault lines along which Jews are tearing themselves apart throughout the diaspora and indeed in Israel is just this, that the peoplehood Jews on the one side and the comfort democracy Jews on the other.
Yeah, it's this tribalism that really overcomes all other rational thought. So we see these leftists in the centrist fundamentalists cloaking themselves in the sleek satin of what you call, I think you said somebody else coined the phrase, but their luxury beliefs. Of course, a man can be a woman. And of course, as a white person, I am personally responsible for an unrelated slave owner who existed a century before my family even arrived in this country. Down with us, as you say. But where is the intelligence when luxury beliefs and tribalism become literally suicidal? These socialites for socialism, and again, the Jews for jihad, do they see their support as purely performative? Like they're aiming to incite no real results? Or are they truly this ignorant and complacently suicidal? Like, which is the luxury here? Is it the belief or the suicide?
I think I'm going to have to begin to draw this to a close. My kids are messaging me for lifts and things, so forgive me if we draw this quite soon. But I think that I think that perhaps the key to understanding it is that these people are very much removed from reality. You know, when they talk about Israel and Palestine, Gaza, they don't mean the real places. Many of them haven't been there. Many of them haven't really left their own country, save for perhaps a package holiday here or there. They've never stepped outside of their own cultural environment and never experienced much hardship. And so they are just very insular in their thinking. And foreign places, foreign people, are symbols for them, really. It's their ciphers, they're symbols of their own politics. They're not real because they've never experienced another reality that's different to their own, perhaps. You know, the novelist Saul Bellow talked about in his book about the Yom Kippur War, what's it called? To Jerusalem and Back, I think, talked about there being not one Israel, but two. One is the Israel of reality that occupies, you know, a tiny bit of land, less than a third of a percent or whatever it is of the Middle East, or the small population, obviously lots of miraculous aspects to it, but basically it's small and it's of limited consequence in the world in some ways. but then you've got the other Israel, which is the Israel of the imagination, the Israel of culture and of civilization. And that Israel, if I remember rightly, he described as broad as the whole of history and as deep as sleep. And it's that Israel of our imagination, of the spirit, of our culture, that is so powerful and becomes all-consuming for people. But it isn't necessarily the Israel of real people and the real place. It's something that it's a reflection of us, of our own societies here in the West. It's about us. You know, William Blake described the New Jerusalem, or Jerusalem being in England. You know, this green and pleasant land, is Jerusalem. It's not, of course it isn't Jerusalem, but it's in an imagination it is. And I think that in a similar way, people who, like you say, Jews who oppose Israel, or even, not even Jews, but activists who oppose their own society that keeps them safe and that has given them not just the greatest human flourishing in all of history, but also the freedom to express their animosity that no other society would give them. They rail against it. They don't realize what they're doing because they're just playing a game. They're playing a game of identity politics. They're trying to perform their anti-establishment feelings, their frustration, the pettiness of their insular lives. They want to pose as a particular, you know, a political activist, as somebody of the left, as somebody's anti-establishment, as somebody who's just right, who's virtuous, who's against all the evils of capitalism and slavery and colonialism and all that. It's about them fashioning their identity. It's nothing to do with reality. And if they were to become successful in overturning the West, triggering the destruction of Israel, then the last words they would cry before their throats are slit would be "Free, free Palestine."
Wow. Okay, I sort of want to end on that because that's a brilliant quote. But at the same time, I don't really want to end on that. Could your kids wait one more minute, or can I invite you back for another show?
No, let's go. Let's have one more run at this and try to bring it home, and I'll have to go back into giving teenagers lifts that they should really walk.
Okay.
I think one of them's carrying lots of booze somewhere, so she needs a lift because she can't carry all the booze she's carrying.
Oh, wow.
She's
Okay.
18. She's 18 next week. So in
Wow.
Britain, you can drink at 18.
Okay, I was gonna say in America is 21, so
Yeah.
okay, so despite all this there's a lot of sadness, there's a lot of darkness, there's a lot of happiness in this world, and particularly as a Jew, I mean, let's be honest, but at the same time, we're witnessing this remarkable phenomenon of Israeli happiness. Even in wartime and in the darkest of times, this year, 2025, Israel is ranked the fifth happiest country on earth. To put that in perspective, UK is number 19, the US is number 21. I know I have a different explanation for this than yours, but can you explain how do you see why is this phenomenon occurring, and how significant do you think it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think those figures actually are last year's. I think this
No,
year.
I looked it up. It said 2025, but
Okay.
maybe.
Well, in my from memory, I think
I know you
we could
said eight. Yeah.
one of us is right, one of us is wrong. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that Israel's fallen to number 8, and Britain is 24, and America is 25 or so.
Okay.
Italy's about 40.
Yeah.
Anyway, either way, it's the same pattern. Why is this? I mean, I think that Dan Senor's book is really the best on this, The Genius of Israel. You couldn't get a better explanation than that, I think. Yeah, but I think for me, what it boils down to is, I went to Israel in 2023 with my kids, and one of my daughters hadn't been there before, and she said she was very amazed by it and said that it feels like people have a reason to live here. I think that's what it boils down to. People have a reason for being. They have a sense of meaning, and that meaning is bound up with feeling like you're part of the family of the nation, that everyone is, Kol Yisrael Aravim Zeh Lazeh, everyone's responsible for each other, everyone's in the same boat, you're kind of related to everybody, and everyone looks after each other. And I think that sense of national kinship is what gives people social meaning and a sense of identity, to use that much maligned term. I think that really lies at the heart of it.
I think you're absolutely right, but I want to stack on that because there's a very popular axiom about living each day as if it's your last. Israelis have always lived that way because, realistically speaking, the threat of annihilation is always looming. Every day and every night can just as easily be their last. It's the kind of reality that I think is impossible for Westerners to really grasp, and the kind of reality that's impossible for any Israeli to really let go of. I noticed this from the first time I went there, that was the conclusion I drew decades ago, and I'm sticking to it. So last question is a quick one. Jake Wallace Simons, what do the words Am Yisrael Chai mean to you?
Well, I mean, death is interesting, isn't it? Yeah. You're talking about death. It's one of those, there it's it's one of the only inevitabilities about life, isn't it? And there's something that is flawed with trying to deal with it by ignoring it. And that's what we do on the whole in the West, where death has become so removed from our life. And like you say, in Israel, there is a certain more of a proximity to the possibility of it. So perhaps it makes their lives a bit more real and vivid in some way. I don't know. But having said that, Am Yisrael Chai, I mean, the Chai part means life rather than death. And I suppose life is such an evocative word, and it means not just survival, because of course the Jews will survive as they have for thousands of years. And as I say in my book, this current moment, it's not actually the Jews who are in danger, it's the West that's much more of a worry than the Jews. But it's also contained within Chai is physical life, but also the spirit of living. and of being alive. And you know, for you know, we see those videos from Jerusalem of people celebrating births and circumcisions, and particularly marriages under fire, with rocket fire raining down above their heads. You know, it's the expression of living, which is as much a rebuke to those who wish us to be dead as anything else. You know, the Holocaust was about not just taking away physical life, but taking away the spirit and the culture and the civilization of Jews. And it almost succeeded, but didn't. And this one will fail too.
Wow. Jake, thank you so much for joining me. This has been an absolute honor and a pleasure. And I relish every word. You are just such a brilliant speaker and such an eloquent writer. Thank you for sharing your book with me. And Shabbat Shalom, Am Yisrael Chai, and an open invitation to come back for a conversation anytime.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.